Good morning. It's been here at Wildflower Zendo. The events of the past weeks have been very traumatic and presented a lot of difficulty and concern in my life and the life of family and friends. This year on Rohatsu, on December 8th, the holiest day of the Zen Buddhist calendar, the day which we celebrate the awakening of Lord Buddha, some 2,500 odd years ago. This year, myself, along with a group of friends, took part in the International Day of Support to Free Mumia Abu Jamal from death row in Pennsylvania. And many of you know that I have been very concerned with issues, particularly surrounding the death penalty and particularly dealing with prisoners. For over 10 years, prisons, prison conditions, social justice, and the recognition and work towards the understanding of the nature of oppression have been very much a part of the activities of the Engaged Zen Foundation. And this year we've taken some tentative steps in terms of expanding our activities, and certainly Wildflower Zendo has been a part of the Engaged Zen Foundation. We have recently started a youth group, and that also is very much a part of EZF. We've been doing classes in our home to address some of the issues that are of concern to young people, particularly high school students. On December 8th, we traveled to Philadelphia. Ian and Chris and myself and Dakota all went down, and we took part in the rally and march in the center city. It was a very cold and raining day. We listened to the speeches at the city hall, and from there we proceeded to march with in a permitted march. All city permits had been acquired, and it was a perfectly legal march. We marched to the intersection of interestingly, Lotus and 13th Street, which is the site of the shooting of Officer Faulkner some 20 years ago. At that point, a video was shown in a on a portable TV screen on the back of a pickup truck with the videotaped confession of a man called Arnold Beverly, who actually is admitting to the murder of Officer Faulkner and denying Mumia's involvement in this crime. Following the video, we moved north on 13th Street and made a left-hand turn onto Walnut Street, and we were headed towards the Ethical Society building, which was the end of the march. As we marched along, I was engaged in conversation with a journalist who is a friend, and we were sharing some information about a couple of other death row cases. At a certain point, when we came close to the end of the march, we were, our attention was directed to some people behind us who were shouting, "Stop, stop the parade. They're arresting and beating people behind us." And of course, we all turned around on hearing this and looked down the street, and there was a crowd formed, and there was a rather large gap in the march. So people started heading in the direction of the crowd that had formed, and we joined them. As I was standing outside this crowd trying to see what was going on, there was such a depth of people there that, and some were holding umbrellas, it was impossible to see from my perspective what was going on at all. So all I saw really was heads and umbrellas. And at that point, from my left side, a police officer with a nightstick, a black gloved hand, and a wooden nightstick, brown wood nightstick, struck me in the chest and knocked me backwards into the street. And I fell over backwards and slammed my head on the pavement. I saw stars, and I heard a rushing sort of sound, and I was unconscious for a period of time. And finally came to with police officers pulling on my jacket and shouting at me. And I was very disoriented. I was confused. My chest was very painful. I had angina pains, and my head was throbbing from the impact. To make a long story short, I actually was then thrown down on the pavement again and handcuffed and arrested and placed in a paddy wagon and driven off. I wasn't able to even get myself seated in the paddy wagon. I was barely able to get up off the floor, and I was getting really worried because the chest pains and the headache were just not letting up. And finally, the people in the paddy wagon pounded on the outside of the van and drew the attention of the police, who finally came in and took me out, put me in an ambulance, and took me to the hospital. And after going through a period of testing and observation and blood tests and EKG were done and my medical history was taken, during which time I informed them that I did have heart disease and that I had a stent installed in my left coronary artery last July. I was given nitroglycerin, which stopped the chest pains immediately, but really intensified the headache. And finally, I was given a painkiller and 10 milligrams of Valium, which did their job, and I promptly went to sleep. When I woke up, I was faced with a room full of detectives who began by asking me why I was there, and I told them my heart condition, and they said, no, why was I arrested? And I said, I don't know why I was arrested. Would you please tell me why I was arrested? And they didn't know. They didn't know that why I'd been arrested. I asked them what the charges were. They didn't know what the charges were. I said, who arrested me? And they didn't know that either. And finally, after another couple of hours, I was released from the hospital, and I was told that I was free to go, that there were no charges against me. And I promptly came home and wrote a narrative of this experience, which I published as part of the support for those other people who were also arrested, who faced very, very serious charges. The situation on the street in Philadelphia in the march was precipitated by the arrest of one young man, and this is a scene of the arrest. And as you can see, there's a police officer with a handgun with his finger on the trigger, which he pointed at the young man's neck and then pointed, also threatening the crowd with the weapon. And last night I heard from one of the leaders of the coalition down there that the police department was now claiming that this individual was in the process of retrieving his weapon from the young man who had evidently taken it away from him. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. That's not what the video shows. I received a letter, an email, actually this morning, from a person who said, greetings. I just read your account of the Philly police riot. While I too am amazed at the actions of the police, I want to say that I'm amazed at the great work Buddhists have done around the world for social change, a lot of it done under extreme conditions. Please continue your work. I'm working with a group trying to set up a Buddhist peace fellowship in Portland, and I'm very interested in American Buddhism and its work with social change. It is tough for me to talk to other Buddhists in the area about anger and hate and protesting. Many feel that protesting just projects out more anger. I can understand where they're coming from and counter that protesting is work done for others, not the self. Can you give me some thoughts on this? Thank you. Well, this, I read this message actually very early this morning, and I thought, this is absolutely a wonderful point and something that I need to take the time to address, and I actually began to write a response, and it's not complete yet. but I did want to bring it here and share it with people because I think that it might be helpful, and it might also serve as a jumping off point for some discussion. Thank you for your email. You mentioned Portland, but I'm uncertain if you mean Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine. I can understand your difficulty in talking with other Buddhists. This is a difficult path in many respects. Most American Buddhists are from the privileged white class. It is difficult to see this for most of those who are a product of the institutional and cultural preferential treatment they receive. White privilege and racial oppression are very much a part of the system, each supported by the other. Oppression is prevalent throughout society. Even non-ruling class whites are oppressed on the basis of class, gender, sexuality, religion, culture, ethnicity, age, physical ability, intellectual ability, scholastic background, and political background. Yet, even as oppressed as they might be, they experience great privilege in relation to people of color. This white privilege is a major barrier in bringing about real fundamental change in the creation of non-oppressive alternative social systems. American Buddhists have also inadvertently adopted belief systems that stifle change out of ignorance and unwillingness to carefully examine Buddhist history. So many of us practice with a set of preconceived ideas that our practice is about creating states of mind which are serene, tranquil, and totally devoid of any conflicting emotion or negativity. This can be said to be a simple-minded approach to practice. In the past, this was referred to a Hinayanistic perspective. In many cases, it is a manifestation of a wish to escape from negativity rather than an exploration of the cause of the problem and a creation of an alternative way of being that is dynamic and alive. Throughout history, Buddhism has been used to control people, as have all religious traditions. Levels of understanding within the traditions exist. Often the full depth of the teachings are held within an elite, while the vast majority of the common people are given watered-down, childlike versions of the teachings to keep them mollified and under control. This is very much a manifestation of the human condition and quite understandable. However, it is a form of oppression, perhaps a subtle psychological form, but oppression nonetheless. Anger comes in many flavors, has many faces, not all alike. Anger is very much a state of mind of the individual and cannot necessarily be ascribed to an action without understanding the state of mind of the actor. What to some might appear as a person acting in anger might very well be the dynamic action of the bodhisattva. Unless we understand the mind of the actor, we really cannot say. This is a minefield which many American Buddhists prefer not to tread. It then places the individual in a position of total responsibility. This is not the way of escapism into serenity or the longed for bliss of tranquility. It is the path of engagement that demands responsibility, leaves us open and exposed to reality, to negativity, with no supporting structures buttressing us while we face oppression directly, both within and without. Dynamic engagement involves risk, which is mandated by our vow to save all beings and fully penetrate the Buddha Dharma. Taking part in protest is very much a civic duty. It is the exercising of our rights as citizens, rights which are not exercised like the muscles of the body, atrophy without use, and eventually wither and die. Participating in protests, demonstration, or marching in public for justice, freedom, and the redress of injustice are all very much tied into the great vows for all, They're all very much the direct action of participating in the emancipation of all beings. We may have limited our perspectives on this mandate by thinking conveniently, in order to protect our privilege, that the emancipation of all beings only means liberating them through enlightenment. Hardly. Can we call a prison full of enlightened beings an acceptable establishment, a product of an awakened social order? Not from this perspective. And that is as far as I got this morning in terms of responding to that individual. But I did want to bring it in and share it with people because I think that this issue is very much in the minds of the Buddhist community, particularly nowadays when we begin to see the tremendous turmoil in the world, and particularly the great questioning of the events and the restrictions that are apparently coming into place in the United States regarding our civil liberties and our freedoms and our abilities to assemble and discuss and dissent. Many, many people are finding that the climate has changed dramatically and feel very, very uncomfortable with the changes. So I wanted to bring these matters up and kind of update everyone as to where I've been. I still have twinges of the headache and dizziness that have kind of stuck with me. I'm not 25 years old anymore, and I can't just get bashed around like that and spring right up. It gets more difficult as we get older. EZF is currently in a financial crisis. We are struggling just to be able to survive and get through the next couple of months. It's going to be very difficult. And I have been asking individuals for help, and I'm particularly asking people to assist in fundraising by whatever means possible, short of going out and robbing 7-Elevens or the Federal Reserve or something of that nature. So these are, this is, I guess, the rundown of current events. And at this point, we can certainly open up for questions and commentary.
Okay.
The letter I got from the Philadelphia Fire Department. Yesterday I received a letter from the Philadelphia Fire Department informing me that I owe them $500 for the privilege of being driven in their ambulance for 10 blocks. How am I going to respond to it? Well, I really don't know at this point. I may just present it to my charity care medical clinic that I belong to and see if they'll cover it. If not, I'm going to have to tell the Philadelphia Fire Department that that I simply do not have that kind of money, and that they're going to have to accept payment of $5 a month and handle it that way. But also I'm going to let them know what happened to me, and you know, not that I expect anything will come of it, but you know, what else can I do?
You didn't request the ambulance service.
I didn't request it. I didn't call for it, no. No, but I received the service.
You would need the service at the smack from the Philly Club.
Sure, and they wouldn't have hit me if I wasn't in the march. And, you know, none of this would have happened if my parents hadn't decided to engage in... You know, I mean...
Because the march was legal.
Well, innocent or guilty, I'm faced with a bill right now, and these people are going to, you know, jump up and down and scream. And they're not going to take no for an answer. So all I can do is make gestures.
Are you going to pursue any legal redress on the other?
Possibly. I mean, everyone across the board has been urging me to file suit against the city of Philadelphia.
Back to what the letter, they were saying about the people talking about protests. Like sometimes I think of that kind of spin on Buddhism, on the subtlety, on really taking that to an extreme. And I remember once you read the sutra book, saying that not the goal, but trying to get to a state where your mind is like a block and you go unnoticed throughout the day. It's kind of something to shoot for. Therefore not really, you know,
well,
cause, less effect, maybe.
If we go back and rattle down through all the teachings, we come to the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is that fundamentally life is dukkha, life is dissatisfactoriness. That's the quintessence of life itself, is that fundamental dissatisfaction. And it isn't going to go away. You know, it's intrinsic to the beast itself. It just is its nature. So the question that comes up, and I mean, you know, we, you know, from one perspective, we all want to be happy and avoid pain as much as possible. I mean, this is what drives this. This comes to the really to the second noble truth, that is of the cause of suffering being desire. So really what happens is the desire the desire to be free from suffering in itself becomes another form of suffering. And, you know, this is what we're faced with. Now, are we sitting in practice in order to avoid suffering? Or you know, are we somehow looking for some way out of it? And if we are, if we're looking, that in itself is a cause of pain. It's dissatisfactoriness. It's, you know, I am not satisfied with my present state of mind, my present state of being, therefore I want something beyond. So I've automatically set myself up. I mean, I've set myself up. I don't have what I want. I want, you know, and now I'm busy wanting, which is suffering, dissatisfactoriness. So anytime that, you know, we're faced with that sort of a situation, we're, you know, suffering. So, and this is, you know, this is really very, very understandable and very, very human in nature. When we approach the teachings, we really cannot approach from any other way. We cannot come to them absolutely clean. There would be no point in doing that. So we do approach from the perspective of desire for something other than, you know, what we feel we experience or know. So really, what you know, if we're sitting with the idea that we're going to get somewhere, that we're going to become enlightened or become awakened, we're missing the boat. That is not the awakened state of mind. You know, and the same thing with the idea of sitting to tranquilize the mind. It first of all, it's very, very unrealistic, and it's never going to happen. You know, we talk about, you know, world peace as if this were something attainable. It's not. Human condition prohibits world peace. We can work for degrees of peace. We can work towards, you know, reasonable accommodation, and we can work towards alternatives to, you know, systems that are in place, but it can never, ever be perfect because of the nature of reality itself. Cannot. Impossible. So that's hard to recognize, and in particular in you know, the American Buddhist scene, which is all very much love and light for many people that, you know, have this concept that, you know, Buddhism is, you know, supremely tranquil and, you know, Buddhism is always, you know, pacifistic in nature, never, we do not indulge in anger. But yet anger comes up. And violence occurs. And if we're spending our time attempting to avoid that and escape that, we are not addressing the problem for anyone other than ourselves. And there is a tremendous problem in this world for all beings who suffer under oppressive governments, under oppressive social structures, under, you know, duress from any quarter. And our when we say, however innumerable all beings are, I vow to emancipate them all, that's got to mean all beings, not just this being and not just Buddhist beings and not just those of us who are, you know, working in terms of sitting practice. Sitting practice does not necessarily mean that things are going to be particularly serene and tranquil. They may not be at all. you know, we may be quite surprised to find out that in reality the mind is quite chaotic and moves from, you know, jumps around from place to place, and you know, sitting may not be a tranquil experience at all. The problem with sitting in that sort of a framework of sitting for serenity and for tranquility is that it winds up being a kind of self-hypnosis, and it winds up being delusional in nature. And ultimately, in the end, it does not last. There is always, we can prolong it for, you know, decades, but sooner or later, the truth will penetrate, and there will be disturbance. Nature of reality. So, you know, this is why doing Zazen is a very dynamic practice, and it's not, you know, I mean, it's not like dropping, you know, Thorazine and you know, sitting in you know, total numbness and you know, being totally out of the picture at all. It's about, you know, dynamic stillness. You know, sitting still, and yet the dynamic nature of mind is evident and fully experienced. We're not trying to sit to avoid things, but rather sit to engage and experience reality. Did I answer your question? Did I? Okay. Any commentary?
So you can better emancipate other beings, you know what I mean? So it's not like you're just some guy who read, you know, some Zen books, you know what I mean? It's like you have an understanding, so you can help people go in what you believe is the right direction to emancipate them.
I think that what happens is that through practice, no matter how we come to it at first, through practice we eventually recognize what's referred to as our true nature. And in so doing, it changes our entire perspective as to, you know, the nature of what we call others. Okay, so there is a fundamental understanding that does take place there. This is what is referred to as the awakening of the Buddha. And this is, you know, what happens on Ruhatsu is we celebrating that enlightenment, that awakening experience. This year I happened to get hit by a police keisaku. Damned hardest keisaku I've ever been hit with. but, you know, there is a point at which our entire perspective changes when we comprehend, I think, our true nature. But that does not preclude being involved by any means. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden we have an absolute view of reality that, we no longer have to deal with, the mundane aspects of life, like, eating and sleeping and shitting and, making change in the supermarket and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, it doesn't go away. We may have perfect understanding, but, we still have to put a quarter in the parking meter. That's the reality. So the relative and the absolute need to be seen together. But we do have to have both perspectives, I think, in order to complete the picture. So in practice, that comes up. But I don't think it necessarily should be really seen as a goal either. It's more like a discovery that accidentally happens. But we may have to burn through all of the goal-seeking behavior in order to get to that state of mind where we are able just to simply let go. So we're letting go of everything. In particular, we're letting go of the idea that we're going to somehow get something, or that there's something to awaken to, or somebody who's going to awaken. All of that stuff has to go down the tubes. And it's a process. It's a long process, and it's not necessarily at all a serene and tranquil process. It's not about peace and love. It's not about the whole world being one. It's about reality, and that has what Trungpa Rinpoche used to call the smelly, juicy aspect of life. That aspect of life that may not appear to be so elegant and so serene, but that which is unavoidable. Question? No. I'll go on, take a risk. No. So we might chant our great vows and break early for coffee. How about that? Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a great plan. A path of true wisdom. Thank you all for your attention. We will be sitting again this coming Sunday. Unless, of course, we're all in prison or suffering from anthrax or smallpox or whatever else might be happening in the so-called real world. But thank you all. And this past year, it's really been great to have this and to be able to be here. And we all, it's not my Zendo. I'm grateful for people to be here, because if people didn't come, I wouldn't be here, and vice versa. So I think it's it's certainly appropriate to express gratitude to all of you and to all of the people who come, even from time to time. It's truly a wonderful, wonderful thing and a wonderful opportunity. So, we will chant with great nen, with great dynamism. Shuja muhen segando mono mujin segandan oman murio segan gakubutsu Kubutsudo mujo seganjo shujo muhen segando mono mujin segandan homan mu Seigan gakubutsudo mujo seiganjo. However innumerable all beings are, I vow to emancipate them all. However inexhaustible delusions are, I vow to extinguish them all. However immeasurable Dharma teachings are, I vow to master them all. However endless the Buddha's way is, I vow to follow it.